Second case today is 2012 AP 378W. Renzo D. Kiles versus William Pollard. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Kiles is Robert R. Hennick. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. There are two issues before the Court. The primary issue for this Court, and obviously why the Court granted review, is to resolve a longstanding question regarding what the proper process and forum should be for raising a challenge to an attorney's deficient performance that results in a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief not being filed. That's the main issue for purposes of the Court. The main issue for purposes of my client is the second issue, which is whether he is entitled, whatever forum is chosen, whatever process is chosen, whether he is entitled to a hearing. I probably should address the first issue, since that's the main reason we're here. And this actually puts me in an interesting position, because both the State and I today are here basically, it doesn't really matter to us which one the Court chooses, as long as the Court chooses one. So everybody knows what the right answer is. So we're basically here to help the Court along with the policy issues and
you think the Court needs help?
What's that?
You think the Court needs help?
Counsel, you have a right to remain silent. You have a right to counsel.
Basically, our position, and we have taken opposing positions on this, and both sides are reasonable, but that's why we have courts. Our position is that the proper procedure is a common law habeas petition, a Knight petition in the Court of Appeals. The State is taking the position that it should be a common law habeas in the Circuit Court.
A Rothering petition?
No, a Rothering petition would be a 974-06 motion. Okay. We both agree that 974-06
habeas is better.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, 974-06 is not an appropriate procedure.
Okay.
The statutory substitute for habeas is not the proper procedure. When we look at the decision in State v. Knight, basically all the reasons why the Court held that you should not address ineffectiveness of appellate counsel in a 974-06 motion would apply equally here.
Counsel, oh, I'm sorry, were you done answering?
Yes.
Okay. I wonder why you wouldn't argue, why you wouldn't urge us to open the courthouse doors a little wider and avoid creating a trap for the unwary as well as the wary by saying, what difference does it make? If they file it, the courts can resolve which is the better forum, which is the better venue, rather, for the matter to be heard. If the Court of Appeals thinks that the trial court should have a hearing, they can send it to the trial court, and especially when it comes to pro se litigants, who will not be able necessarily to know the procedure.
I think there are a couple of reasons why we're not just, you know, we don't just want to throw it open. Number one is probably just as a lawyer, I like rules and knowing what the right answer is. And I get a number of what Howard Eisenberg used to call pen pal letters from inmates in prison, many of whom know they can't afford to hire me, but are just looking for advice. And sometimes I end up sending, I don't know whether the form from the last argument was something that I had sent out or not. Just basic, standards. This is what you need to allege.
An 8-pound letter.
Yes. Yes. And it is much easier if I know what the answer is. In this particular case, for instance, in the appendix to his petition, he included a response from me when he was trying to find out what the proper process would be. So having an actual answer here would be a tremendous help to whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a pro se person.
Why wouldn't that I don't follow your answer. I thought Justice Gableman was saying to you, well, if you file it in the Court of Appeals and it needed a hearing, the Court of Appeals can just send it to the trial court. And if you file it in the trial court and you're asking for an extension of the time to file a notice of appeal, and only the Court of Appeals can grant that, why shouldn't the trial court just send it to the Court of Appeals and let them deal with it?
Just let me clarify with a question. Are you suggesting that the circuit court, for instance, could just transfer a habeas petition to the Court of Appeals?
I think his question to you was, why shouldn't the court send the motion, however captioned, to the correct court? And you're saying it can't happen or it shouldn't happen. I'm not quite sure.
I'm not saying that. And I know that, for instance, in federal court, in this court system, if a motion is filed or something is filed in the Court of Appeals, it properly should be in the Supreme Court. It will be transferred there or vice versa. I have no problem with a process like that. What I am arguing for is that the court that you ultimately send it to needs to be defined.
Okay, I gotcha.
Okay.
Thank you. Define that.
And the way that we are defining it is it should be the Court of Appeals given three reasons. Number one.
In this case, the correct court that should be dealing with your client's matter is the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
Wherever it's filed. If it's filed here or in circuit court or wherever.
Right.
Okay, why?
And it should be in the night petition in the Court of Appeals. Number one, the two sides have gone back and forth on this whole issue of the locus of the ineffectiveness. In this case, it's any of three things. One is the failure to file the notice of intent when Kyle says that he informed his lawyer that he wanted to appeal. Two is not being...
Is this intent to appeal or intent to file a post-conviction motion?
Actually, it's the intent to take the matter further, because you don't know whether it's going to be an appeal or a post-conviction motion
right.
until after the lawyer reviews
okay,
things.
Okay, so it's the filing of a notice of intent to
yes.
proceed further. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, basically to take the next step, so the lawyer would get the transcripts, review the transcripts, decide
okay.
whether or not there are any grounds to appeal further, and then make a decision at that point.
Okay, that's one.
That's one. Second is the lawyer, in this case, for instance, the notice of appeal rights was marked as undecided. And so the defendant knows that he has to decide within 20 days, but the lawyer is not reasonably available. In this case, the documentation that Mr. Kyles included with his petition shows that he made three attempts to phone his attorney during that 20-day period. Two of them were rejected by the office. They wouldn't accept the calls. So they knew who was coming in, who was calling, but they refused to accept it. The third one just wasn't an answer. So that's the second, that a lawyer doesn't have to be, change his or her schedule to wait by the phone for a call, but has to be reasonably available to accept the calls or respond to calls from either the defendant
that,
or
does the
mother.
State agree with the first two?
Yes.
All right. What's the third?
The third one is once the time had passed. In this case,
20 days passed.
Once this 20 days had passed, that was, I think, December 2nd. Let's see, on January, I think it was 24th, so less than 60 days later, the lawyer actually meets with Mr. Kyles at Waupun, and they talk. And it becomes absolutely clear then, even if the lawyer didn't get the letter, even if the lawyer didn't get the phone messages, it was absolutely clear at that point that Kyles wanted to appeal or pursue this matter further. The lawyer's response was, the time has passed, and besides, there are very few issues, given that you pled guilty, there are few issues that could be addressed on an appeal. He never told the defendant that you could file a motion to extend. He never filed a motion to extend, and our argument in this case is that a lawyer in that position, a reasonable lawyer in that position, knowing that there had been this mix-up, this miscommunication beforehand would have at least advised his client that this is what you want. You want the appeal. This is how you have to do it. And either would have advised the client how to do it or would have done it himself.
Counsel, but in order to get an extension from the Court of Appeals to proceed for matters after conviction, you have to show good cause.
Exactly.
Okay, so what's a good cause here?
Good cause would be any of three things. Number one, that the lawyer was told, as the state has admitted, those first two points of ineffectiveness. That the lawyer was told he didn't file the notice of intent.
Lawyer denies that. You know that.
Okay, lawyer denies that. Second is that the lawyer wasn't reasonably available. Even if the lawyer denies that, what we have is that the defendant tried to contact him. Even if the lawyer didn't know that the defendant was trying to contact him, it's now clear to him that that Kyles was trying to contact him and therefore intended to appeal, but it was because of this mix-up in communication would make good cause in order to extend the time. This is only 60 days.
I mean, doesn't he have to show a meritorious defense to the claim or anything?
Not at all. No.
Not at all. Nothing.
No.
He just has to say, we didn't connect, and it was basically not my fault that we didn't connect.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Counsel, if you're here to guide us, in part, you started out earlier indicating that both parties here have agreed that it is the habeas rather than a 974-06. Do I recall correctly? Some references made in the briefs about the Quackenbush case. And the Quackenbush case, I think, dealt with, should we do a habeas on a motion? Was it a motion to extend time? Was a motion to extend time or habeas?
Quackenbush was a motion to extend time.
Yes. And the court indicated the preferable vehicle there is the motion to extend time rather than the habeas.
Yes.
Do your earlier comments affect Quackenbush at all and its holding vis-a-vis motion to extend time in habeas?
Quackenbush, as I read it, does not apply to issues of where you're actually raising it as an ineffectiveness claim. There is, I believe, some major tension between this Court's decision in Evans, which is some members of the Court may recall, I argued, and the Quackenbush case, in terms of whether certain issues have to be raised by a night petition or or can be raised by a motion to extend. I believe that Quackenbush does an excellent job of explaining the problems with a strict application of Evans. For instance, in Quackenbush, one of the errors was a lawyer miscalculated the deadline for the notice of intent and filed it one day late. Do we really want to go through the whole night process for only an extension that's one day late? Another one, I think, was less than 60 days, or I think it was 3 months, 90 days in that case. And the question is whether we want to go through this whole process when something can be more efficiently done through a motion to extend. But Quackenbush, there is some language in Quackenbush that is kind of against my position. It refers to the error as taking place in the circuit court, and therefore it might be more appropriate in the circuit court to address it. However, I think that's mistaken, and it is dicta in any event. The issue of location of the error, the state's saying that this is the trial attorney who is filing it. It's actually whoever represented the defendant at sentencing is obligated to file it, although if the attorney who represents at sentencing is discharged and a new attorney is hired to do the appeal, then it's that attorney's obligation to file, and that attorney never appeared in the circuit court. And in any event, the filing of the notice of intent takes place after the circuit court trial, the sentencing, the entry of judgment. All of that is completed. Everything that we think of in terms of the trial court process has completed. So even though it may be the same attorney, it's not really the trial attorney who is filing the notice of intent as the trial attorney. Yes,
could,
I'm sorry.
Could I ask you, the court is certainly aware of your filings in the Starks case.
Yes.
And to be candid, one of the reasons we took this case is to further reflect on the Starks case. I don't quite see that the argument you're making today is consistent with the argument that you made in the Starks reconsideration motion.
Oh, I can explain that. If the court looks at the Smalley decision, it sets it out quite well, which is that there are basically three types of ineffectiveness claims that can be raised, or three circumstances in which ineffectiveness is raised after after the conviction. One is where there is an error that is in the briefing or the oral argument in either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, and those obviously are handled in either a Knight petition or a Smeltzer petition in that particular court. The second is where the post-conviction attorney fails to make a particular argument in the course of an ongoing appeal. That, for instance, is a case where the defendant goes directly to the Court of Appeals without filing a Mockner motion, without filing a motion challenging the effectiveness of trial counsel.
These are Starks facts?
What's that?
These are Starks facts?
No, these are the... That would be Starks facts, yes. Where they don't file it, the post-conviction motion, that is a predicate required to argue that claim in the Court of Appeals. You do argue in the Court of Appeals. You raise other issues in the Court of Appeals, but you didn't raise that predicate motion. You omitted that in the circuit court. That's handled by Rothering. The Rothering decision points out that errors by post-conviction counsel in an ongoing appeal process are handled in the circuit court. The third issue, or the third situation where post-conviction counsel can make a mistake, is by failing to commence an appeal at all. And under those circumstances, there is nothing that happens in the Court of Appeals. There's nothing that happens in the circuit court. And that is the process that we are handling today regarding Mr. Kyles.
Mr. O'Neill, say that the cases that you cite for this proposition, that in those cases there was a notice of intent to file post-conviction relief, and then nothing after that.
Yep, exactly correct.
Here we do not have a notice of intent to file post-conviction relief. So why? And isn't that done in the circuit court? And don't you want an evidentiary hearing in the circuit court?
We want an evidentiary hearing that can also be handled by a Knight petition and a remand to the circuit court or to a referee. It's the court made clear in Knight that it doesn't necessarily have to be the circuit court, although in my experience, that's the way it generally happens. So there's a hearing no matter which, whether it's a Knight petition or whether it's in the circuit court first. But back to your original question. There was nothing that happened afterwards. There's no ongoing appellate process. So this isn't Starks. This isn't Rothering. This is more the Santana, the Smalley, Evans referred to it as well in a footnote, that when the lawyer's error results in the failure to commence appellate proceedings, that should be handled in a Knight petition. Now, the Smalley court explained that as being, well, if you miss the deadline for a notice of intent, or in that case, I think it was, They were referring to both 80930 deadlines and 80932, the no merit deadlines. If you miss a deadline, if you fail to file something, then essentially what you're asking for is an extension of time for doing that. And that the failure to request that extension is something that happens in the Court of Appeals. So actually the locus of the error was the Court of Appeals. That's the logic in Smalley. And that logic applies equally where the failure is to file a notice of intent, because you still do not have any, you fail to commence the process. You know, it never happens. You don't get any appeal at all. Now, the state has argued the flip side of that, that this, you know, physically you file the document in the circuit court. And that's one way to look at it. I tend to prefer the Smalley procedure, and that I believe is more reasonably explained. The second point, however, is where or which court is able to grant the remedy. And in Knight, this court held that the circuit court, technically you could go through this whole rigmarole process of vacating the judgment and reinstating the judgment and therefore giving 20 days in order to do a new notice of intent. But the court refers to that as an oblique way of doing it. You are not doing it in the way that is most efficient and most effective. The way that's most efficient and most effective is the Court of Appeals, which has alone the authority to extend the time for filing the notice of intent under 809.82. So that's why makes more sense. Also, we have, as exemplified by this case, you can have as many as three different, in this case, bases for arguing ineffective assistance of counsel. Two of them, the state says, should be in the circuit court. One, the state agrees, would be in a Knight petition in the Court of Appeals. Do we really want to, going back to making this easier for litigants, especially pro se litigants, do we want to have them forced to raise some claims in one court, some claims in the other court, when you're looking for the same remedy? And one court, the Court of Appeals, can grant the entire remedy, can address all of the issues. Now, just very quickly, if I could address the second issue. The state says that Mr. Kyles procedurally defaulted these claims because of his prior filings. Number one, the prior Knight petition was not ruled on the merits. It was an issue of competency, which is inherently not a decision with prejudice. The circuit court decision, it was a habeas petition originally. The court misconstrued it as a 97406 petition. It denied it for failing to state a claim because the allegations were not sufficient. In Schatz v. McCautry, State Extra Schatz v. McCautry, this court held that when a complaint, in that case it was a certiorari, so it also was an equity case, when a complaint is dismissed for failure to state a claim because the pleading was insufficient, then the petitioner is free generally, the language is generally is free to come back with a new complaint that actually contains all of the missing elements. So even if that was a ruling in the circuit court on the merits, it was not indicated in the motion that it was with prejudice. Under Schatz, he would be entitled, Kyles would be entitled to raise this motion again in the circuit court as a habeas, have the court consider it as a habeas, and decide it as a habeas based on whatever standard this court should decide. So issue number one, we should end up with
Why shouldn't we just say enough already? I mean, he's been to state court, he's been to the trial court, he's been to the Court of Appeals, he's been to the federal court, now he's back to us. Why isn't this the case for Escalona?
Number one, Escalona only applies to 97406 motions. Number two, although an Escalona-type analysis has been applied in habeas petitions, also is an equitable claim that I think would be controlled by Schatz that hasn't been overruled. Number three, and I think probably most important, is constitutionally you can't. Under Coleman, under Murray v. Carrier, under the Court of Appeals Seventh Circuit decision in Betts v. Litcher, the state cannot leave a defendant involuntarily without counsel and then deny him counsel based on the kind of mistakes that we expect people to make.
You're assuming an awful lot, Counselor. I mean, his trial counsel, who he hired, I guess, himself, vehemently denied that he was ever asked to proceed beyond the conviction. So it's not that counsel didn't do it and was asked to do it as a slam dunk, right? And he did send a notice to the trial court, and the trial court, and saying that he had sent a letter requesting within the 20-day period that further proceedings go on. Trial court denied his motion and said, but if you send me a copy of the letter, I will reconsider my motion. But he didn't do anything. He never sent a copy of the letter, right?
Look at the circuit court's decision. Judge Sankovich was confused on one thing. Number one, the issue wasn't the letter, but what he said in the letter. The letter is evidence of what he said.
Of course.
And the reason why Judge Sankovich denied the motion is because Mr. Kiles did not specifically allege that he said in the letter that I want to appeal. What he said in that motion, or what this particular, you know, rather incompetent jailhouse lawyer said in that motion, is that during the 20-day period, I sent a letter to my lawyer concerning the 20-day period. He didn't specifically say, I told him I wanted to appeal. So that is a pleading problem. That particular jailhouse lawyer was incompetent.
Even if it was pled in a way that wasn't thorough enough, why didn't he just send Judge Sankovich a copy of the letter and get the reconsideration at that level? I mean, we've been going on here for years and years and years since, 2002?
Yes. And the reason he didn't send the letter is because at the time that he sent the letter, he did not know. It's alleged in the Knight petition. He did not know that he had to keep a copy. So he did not have a copy. The person who would have a copy is the lawyer. And contrary to what
Lawyer said he never got any such letter.
Yes. However, there also is that's an issue of fact. That's why we have hearings. Because it's an issue of fact. The lawyer says one thing, the defendant says another thing, and when we look at, for instance, the credibility, the fact that Mr. Kiles presented this letter to the court shows that he's not trying to hide something.
He didn't present it to the court. The court never got the 2002 letter.
I'm talking about the subsequent October, I think it is,
of
2003
the letter that his attorney sent back because he filed an ethical complaint against him, correct? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And that raises a factual issue for a hearing, yes. The question is whether, because Kyle says one thing, he sent the letter, the lawyer says, you never told me this, he says, I did tell you this, that's why we have hearings. And bottom line is that under Coleman, under Murray, under Betts, at some point we have to decide whether or not he was unconstitutionally denied his right to counsel. And we can't cut off his availability of that remedy merely by saying you haven't already proven it. That's why we have hearings. Thank you.
Now, you're not done, Mr. Hannah.
Your Honor.
You and the state apparently disagree on something. What exactly do you disagree with? Exactly. And then I'm going to ask you, is your position today, it's a question that Justice Prosser asked you, is it consistent with your position in the Starks reconsideration? There you thought that Rothering applied. I gather here you don't think Rothering applies.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Addressing that issue, first, Rothering does not apply here because there was a failure to commence the appeal process. So this is a Smalley case. It's not a Rothering case.
Okay.
Rothering case is where there was an appeal process. It went through the Court of Appeals, and just along the way, the lawyer in the post-conviction court made a mistake, either an affirmative mistake or an omission. that impacted the ability to continue the appeal from that point. Where we disagree, where the state and I disagree, is number one, whether the specific pleadings in this case justify a hearing on the third issue, or the third ineffectiveness issue.
I got that.
Whether this should be in the circuit court as a habeas petition or in the court of appeals as a habeas petition.
All right. So, and you are saying it should be in the court of appeals, if I understand that, and if they need a hearing, the court of appeals could send it to the circuit court or appoint a master or a referee,
yes,
which they don't do usually. Okay?
Yes.
All right.
Third disagreement is that the state is arguing procedural default, that by raising these issues over the last 11 years when he's been left to fend for himself with his sixth grade reading level and whatever, you know, jailhouse lawyers are willing to help him, that he made mistakes, the kind of mistakes that in Betts v. Litcher, the court pointed out, we expect unrepresented litigants to make. And the state says that's procedural default. We say that isn't.
Procedural default to raise any issue now.
Right.
All right.
And there is one final issue. The state is claiming that the third point ineffectiveness claim was not included in the petition for review. And our position on that is that although it could have been more expressly included, the facts clearly are there, and we have to liberally construe.
And regardless of whether it's in the petition, we can handle it, right?
Yes.
Has it been briefed?
Yes.
So,
fully briefed by both sides.
I have another question for you. In Starks, and I'm going to read from paragraph 4. Right? And both the state and the defendant disagreed with paragraph 4, at least in part. At the outset, we know that there is a procedural problem in this case. Starks 97406 motion, which was filed with the circuit court, alleged ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. However, the attorney who represented him after his conviction didn't file any post-conviction motions and instead pursued a direct appeal. He was thus not Starks' post-conviction counsel, but was rather appellate counsel. And both you and the state said, no, he was post-conviction counsel. This is, now I'm going back to reading Starks, and this is the important part. This is significant, whether you call him post-conviction or whether you call him appellate, because claims of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel must be filed in the form of a habeas with the Court of Appeals. That's citing Knight. Okay. And this is the kicker. By bringing his claim in the circuit court, Starks pursued his case in the wrong forum. However, because the erroneous filing deprived the circuit court of competency rather than jurisdiction, our review of this case is appropriate. So this court said, hey, wherever you filed it, right or wrong, we're going to get to the merits of the case. So, you've been asked in several forms questions like, hey, maybe we ought to get rid of Knight, get rid of Rockring, get rid of all of these, where you file post-conviction, where do you file appellate counsel, where do you file a post-conviction counsel makes an error, or whether it doesn't do anything, all of which are details of where you file, and maybe you just should have a motion, call it what you will, maybe a habeas or maybe something else. If it doesn't fit under 97406, you have a generic motion which counsel can bring anywhere they like. Mm-hmm. And we won't count you out. We'll take care of you. Or the circuit court can take care of you, or the court of appeals can take care of you, wherever you file it. You won't file it here, right? That's out of the question. Okay?
Yes.
You don't need any more motion practice here. Motion practice is below.
If you did, we could send it back, though, Mr. Hannigan.
Yes, of course.
No, we'll hear it on the merits, okay. Just like in Stark.
That's your position today, yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So what do you think of that? I mean, you would ask that. You say, well, you like rules, you like to know where you what you should do.
I think knowing what should be done is important. But if the answer to that question is that you can file it either in the circuit court or in the court of appeals as a habeas, that I think would be probably a good change. In federal court, for instance, there is 2255 motions, and that's discussed in the Knight decision, and also the fact that a number of other states address things differently than we do. In federal court, it is a 2255 petition in the district court, and you can challenge the ineffectiveness of trial counsel in that, or you can challenge the ineffectiveness of appellate counsel. One concern that I have, and that is that if we, as long as we don't combine it with 97406.
Well, that's my point,
yes.
Ultimately. And that's why I asked you the question only as to habeas. Because if you do 97406, then we do have a body of law in that it hasn't run into trouble. Well, it did in Starks, but there are special reasons for that. And
yes. The main reason not to combine, for instance, in this case, the failure to commence an appeal, combining that with a 97406 petition, you have the unrepresented defendant having to argue in the same motion, number one, I'm entitled to reinstatement of my direct appeal rights and the appointment of counsel or the assistance of counsel, but in that same motion, given Escalon and Arana, you also have to raise all of your constitutional claims. So you also have to raise, and my right to, you know, to be free from searches and seizures was violated. My trial attorney was ineffective. All these things before you even get the lawyer that you're entitled to on a direct appeal. So combining the two would be
combining what two?
Keeping them separate wouldn't.
Combining what two, counsel?
Combining the motion to challenging the combining a 97406 motion with a motion challenging the effectiveness of counsel for failing to commence an appeal. Combining those two things.
How do you challenge a counsel for failing to file an appeal now?
Failing to file a brief in the Court of Appeals? That's a Knight petition.
That's what I thought. So
and
you want
to
file
be careful. Merit, same thing.
You want to keep Rothering and Knight as law, and you want the habeas to work where you don't have a 97406 available.
Well, a Knight's a habeas.
And then you can file, if I hear what you said correctly, you can file the habeas in either the trial court or the Court of Appeals, and they should sort it out.
If I understand correctly, then yes. Essentially, the things that need to be in a 97406 motion are in a 97406 motion. If you can't put it in there, for instance, a Knight-type issue, a Rothering-type issue, a failure to commence, Smalley-type issue, that could be filed in either the Court of Appeals or the Circuit Court as a habeas petition, and that court would decide where the most appropriate place is without it being, you know, thrown out because of being inappropriate.
You know, one of the problems, and it's my problem, is, you know, I can follow the rules of civil procedure and appeal quite simply. You got X number of days, you file a notice of appeal, and you get the transcript, you file your brief. You know, it's lickety-split, and the time periods are easy to follow. When I have to deal with a criminal case and deal with the notice of intent and then deal with getting the transcript and deal with then making decisions, all of which can take weeks and months, right?
Sometimes years, yes.
And sometimes years. I have to reread those sections of the rules over and over again because they are not intuitive to me. They aren't to you because you do it all the time and you know where the pitfalls are and why it works the way it does. But for someone who gets it once every 2 or 3 or 5 years, none of this is intuitive. So what are you going to do about it?
Well, could I interject? We've gone well over your time, but can I ask if this is what you're asking for? File where the error occurred, when it's clear where the error occurred, and if it may be a mixed issue of trial court or court of appeals, you could file either place.
Not entirely. It's clear if an error is in briefing or oral argument in the Court of Appeals, that goes to the Court of Appeals. It's clear petition for review, briefing, oral argument, the Supreme Court, that goes to the Supreme Court. It's clear if there is a post-conviction motion as part of the process of an ongoing appeal, that goes in the circuit court.
Right.
The locus of the error is confusing in exactly the case we have here in Kyle's. Because
so you're saying file either place.
Why is it confusing?
It's confusing because, as the state is arguing, you file the physical document in the circuit court and only in the circuit court. The Court of Appeals doesn't get a copy of that, unlike later filings like the Notice of Appeal. On the other hand, as Smalley points out, Court of Appeals in Smalley, if you miss that deadline, then since the Court of Appeals is in charge of timing, only the Court of Appeals can extend the time, that it also can be viewed as an error in the Court of Appeals because you didn't make the motion to extend. So what I am actually arguing is when it is clear, the knife or the smelter, that's where it goes, or the rothering. When it is a failure to commence, that is the third category that Smalley points out. When it is a failure to commence, that goes in a knife petition. Unless the court chooses to say, we're going to allow it to go to either the circuit court or the Court of Appeals, the process that Justice Gableman raised earlier and the Chief Justice has been suggesting. But it's important that we have, you know, someplace where we can raise all of the claims at the same time.
So if it's a failure to appeal, it goes to the Court of Appeals.
Yes, failure to file a notice of intent, failure to file a post-conviction motion and or any notice of appeal, failure to file a no-merit report, failure to file a no-merit notice of appeal. Things that cut off the appeal, or it's not going any further. That would go into the Court of Appeals. That's what the Court of Appeals said in Santana and Smalley. This court, in a footnote in Evans, also seemed to accept that. None of them dealt with notice of intent, but the logic, the same logic applies in those situations.
Thank you.
Okay. And
what you don't want is divide up a defendant's various claims and put some in circuit court and some in court of appeals and then have it
all pushed. Especially when we're dealing with somebody who might have a sixth grade reading level.
All right. As to one and two, the failure to file a notice of an intent and failure to have the lawyer available, the state agrees that your pleadings are good enough. And ultimately, they're going to have to go to the trial court, aren't they?
I believe so, yes.
For hearing?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
You will have some moments. I'm sorry. Does anyone else have questions? You have several
questions?
Moments in.
Thank you.
Rebuttal. Mr. O'Neill? Aaron R. O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General, representing the respondent, William Pollard.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. There's a lot of agreement between the parties today.
Let me ask you this. What's wrong with the idea that you file where the error occurred? Sometimes it may properly be in either place, but when it's failure to commence the appeal, you file with the Court of Appeals like Knight. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong? That is the holding in of Smalley and Santana, that when there's a failure to commence an appeal, you file a Knight petition. The difference in this case is that there was no notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief filed. That is filed in the trial court. In Santana and Smalley, the notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief was filed. The appellate process had begun. The deadlines under 80930 had begun, and they were invoked, and what happened is that stopped. Under those circumstances, I think in that case, it was appropriate to send the case, especially in the sense where the court says if the counsel failed to file a no-merit appeal, that would definitely have to have been filed in the Court of Appeals. I think there's a little tension between Smalley. If the defendant were to say, I think counsel should have filed a post-conviction motion, and I know that the Starks case sort of wipes that out, but along with
the lawyer in Starks, I've been looking from your...
I'm not the lawyer in Starks.
Go ahead.
But in the sense, I think there's some tension between the Smalley case and the principle that I think the state and Mr. Hennick are challenging in Starks, that where there is an allegation that counsel should have filed a post-conviction motion in the direct appeal, even if no motion was filed, you still file a Rothering petition. There is some tension in that case that there would be a filing in the trial court. But I would distinguish Smalley primarily on the basis that the appellate process simply just hasn't begun in this case. There was never a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief filed in the trial court.
What do you want us to do? You think he filed in the wrong court? Is that right?
In his most recent filing, yes.
All right. So, shall we just dismiss the whole thing?
I think this court needs to resolve this issue.
Resolve it by dismissing it.
I think the court needs to resolve the matter of where the proper court and the proper procedure to file a complaint that counsel was ineffective for not filing a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief. I think that guidance is necessary. I think the case law, especially with respect to Knight, Rothering, et cetera, makes this distinction that says, well, you file, in general, a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel where in the court counsel was alleged to be ineffective. But at the same time, we have this tension that I think is really apparent in this case. I think it's pretty clear that the obligation to file a notice of intent is in the circuit court. It is on the duty of trial counsel, or at least counsel who's representing the defendant in the trial court, even if it's after sentencing.
Notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief or notice of intent to appeal?
Notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief. A notice of intent.
Two different things, right?
Right, correct. A notice of intent to appeal, we agree, if counsel failed to file that, since that would have to be filed in, it's filed in the circuit court as well, but it's filed in the Court of Appeals, and that gives the Court of Appeals jurisdiction. That would be a Knight petition.
Okay. I just wanted to make, because people use the phrase notice of intent, but there's two different times.
Correct.
So I just want to.
It's a cumbersome phrase to say notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief, so I was just sorry. Yeah.
Counsel, on page 17 of your brief, you seem to reconcile the holdings in Smalley and Santana based on your claim that the filing in the Court of Appeals is still logical in those situations. That's what you wrote on page 17 in your brief, because the issue is whether appellate counsel's inaction deprived the defendant of his right to appeal.
Correct.
And that's at the very bottom of page 17 of your brief. That same logic, to me, seems to support a holding that Kyle's claims should be raised in the Court of Appeals, because the issue is whether the counsel's inaction deprived the defendant of his right to appeal.
That's correct. I think that's a fair reading of Smalley. It's just one that we disagree with. The issue in Smalley is we are really talking about appointed post-conviction appellate counsel who is the one who winds up depriving the defendant of an appeal. And here, if the allegations are correct, it was trial counsel who denied the defendant an appeal.
I read that as your statement, not a statement of the Smalley or Santana court. Apparently, I read that incorrectly.
That's our argument in the case, but we agree there are weaknesses to that argument. Mm-hmm. And I think it is a fair reading that the defense has adopted of Smalley and Santana to say, look, if some counsel somewhere deprives the defendant of the right to appeal, maybe just under Smalley, a night petition is the remedy. I think there are strong arguments on both sides.
One of the impediments to your argument for me also is this anomaly that if you want to extend time, the circuit court is without the ability to do that under current statute. So why have, it's complicated enough, why have, if you want to extend time, you go to the Court of Appeals, but if you just want, but otherwise you're in the circuit court. I mean, keep it simple, and wouldn't it be more simple, given the logic that set forth in your brief on page 17, vis-a-vis Smalley and Santana, and the fact that the statute only allows for extension by the Court of Appeals, just do it with the Court of Appeals. What's wrong with that approach?
On the issue of remedy, I think I will agree that our proposed remedy is a weakness for our argument. I think it's what this Court has described as oblique in Knight. It's not something that we would normally think of an appropriate remedy, and obviously the Court of Appeals is in a better position to grant the remedy, but I think our argument is trying to sort of resolve the tension between the case law that says, well, you look where trial counsel or where counsel was ineffective, and that's where you file. And trying to adhere to that principle, I think in this case, the trial court is the place to file it.
The argument, of course, and these facts is maybe it was ineffective because they didn't request an extension of time in the only place where they could have requested an extension of time, which is the Court of Appeals.
Well, and we agree that that needs to be filed in the Court of Appeals.
Sometimes I think the safety net would be a filing in the Court of Appeals. Then the Court of Appeals could always refer it to the circuit court for a hearing on the issue that should have been addressed there.
And that's correct, and that's what happens. I won't concede that that's easier or a safety net, but I will say that that's what happens routinely in Knight filings. There's a sufficient petition to raise an issue of fact that gets sent back to the court of, or the circuit court for resolution, and then back to the Court of Appeals for ultimate resolution of the legal issues.
I mean, the easy answer is when it's clearly at the circuit court and that's the locus of the error, you go there. Court of Appeals, you go there. But when it's this mixed kind of issue, it seems sort of silly to require a filing in the Court of Appeals to have the Court of Appeals send it to the circuit court for a hearing where the circuit court decides whether they should have a hearing and just deprive the party of the opportunity to file it at the Court of Appeals. Maybe both places are a good place. I don't know. I'm trying to be sort of practical here, but what's the problem with that?
I think that really gets into whether this court is going to approve of the state's remedy of vacating and reinstating the conviction. If that's not the case, if that's not an available remedy, I don't know what other remedy the circuit court can do or could provide if the defendant files in the circuit court. The circuit court may be able to hold a hearing, but I don't know what the court does after that hearing. Does it have to refer it to the Court of Appeals to ultimately grant the relief that it should, grant an extension, or just say you have 60 days to file a post-conviction motion?
Well, then maybe the proper place is the Court of Appeals, and they send it there for a hearing. The hearing occurs, then the Court of Appeals takes care of it. Why
absolutely
isn't that the answer?
That's a valid argument, but as the Court of Appeals pointed out in Quackenbush, the attorney who screwed up has never been before them. This is really an issue that only – a filing that only happens in the trial court. And I'd point out that under 973.18, the trial court is really – sort of somewhat intimately involved with informing the defendant of his rights to appeal, rights to file a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief. At sentencing, the court is obliged to inform the defendant that he has the right to relief and the right to counsel to pursue that post-conviction relief. It has to direct trial counsel to confer with the defendant about the rights to post-conviction relief and it has to order counsel and defendant to sign the form acknowledging that the defendant's been notified about his rights. So the trial court is sort of involved with overseeing the process between trial counsel and the defendant about giving the defendant his or her notification of rights to pursue post-conviction relief.
Now, the Court of Appeals in this order just said here there was no appellate counsel, as no intent, notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief was ever filed. Tiles is not entitled to habeas pursuant tonight. And so they denied Kyle's petition ex parte.
Which petition are you talking about? I'm sorry.
I'm hoping I'm dealing with the right one. Appendix 1 in Mr. Hennick's brief.
The decision on the most recent night petition?
Pardon me?
Is it the decision on the most recent night petition or the one from 2004?
This is 2012.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that's the one we're dealing with here.
That's correct.
And there's a later one, June 2012, but that's just the motion for reconsideration is denied. So from the Court of Appeals, Kyle could have gone to the trial court and filed a similar petition?
Based on the most recent filing?
Based on the May 9, 2012 order.
Our position is no, because he's already pursued that remedy. After his first night petition, the Court of Appeals told him to go file in the circuit court, and he did.
And he did not.
He did file in the circuit court.
Okay, and so that's gone.
That's gone, correct. He did not. That was his opportunity to allege the claims that he is now much more thoroughly alleged in his night petition.
Okay, and your position is that the court should affirm this order?
Correct.
Because it's filed in the wrong court and he's already used up all of his remedies.
No, we are asking that the court was correct that it was filed in the wrong court because his remedy is in the circuit court, but we are also asking to find that it was procedurally barred by his previous.
So if you're wrong on that issue, you have an alternative base of procedural bar, right?
Correct.
And if you're wrong on those two, then you say he's entitled to a hearing only on the first two of his three ineffective assistance of counsel. I just want to know
that's
what
correct.
Your position is. So what rule does the state want this court to adopt?
With respect to where the claim should be filed, or we believe that it should be filed in the circuit court pursuant to a habeas petition.
Because
any error by trial counsel in failing to file the notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief happened in the trial court, and consistent with this court's past decisions of the Court of Appeals, a claim of ineffective assistance of trial counsel is filed in the trial court.
Counsel, I'll tell you what causes me to pause, and it's your remedy. Because in other cases, your remedy would be totally unacceptable.
Correct.
Your remedy is, okay, you've missed the deadline. It's the Court of Appeals that can grant the extension of time, not us. So the remedy is, Circuit Court, what you should do is you should vacate the judgment and then reinstate the judgment of conviction so that the 20 days can then run?
Yes.
You see, if in the past we've had plenty of cases dealing with you miss the deadline for filing something, you miss the deadline for appeal.
Yeah.
That's a good example. In the bad old days, you had courts doing this kind of what I would call shenanigans. You know, gosh, I don't want Joe to have a malpractice case. I'm just going to vacate that judgment and reinstate it, and then we'll take the appeal. You know, we can't have what I call shenanigans. Isn't this just another variety on those kind of shenanigans of people missing the deadlines no problem, we'll take care of it. I'll just vacate it so we can start over again.
What we are proposing is a very limited remedy that is contingent on proof of a claim that trial counsel was ineffective for not filing the notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief.
Your response is, okay, Judge, this is just a limited opportunity for shenanigans.
I don't think ineffective assistance of trial counsel preventing someone from beginning their post-conviction proceedings is shenanigans.
No,
I think
what
is
shenanigans is the trial courts engaging in this game playing of, oh, you missed your deadline? Let me vacate the judgment. Then we'll start all over again so you have your new deadlines. That's the shenanigans.
But I think it's this court recognized in, I think it's the Edlin case that I cited in my brief, there are some circumstances where doing this is permissible. And in that case, I believe it was the court failed to send the order to the parties. And so in
that
case.
Right. That I wrote that, I think. Edlin was in La Crosse. But that was the court's error. That wasn't the attorney's error. The court failed to send the decision or send something out. And so that was very limited because, and there was a subsequent case, too, where the clerk of courts, it was totally court error, and we gave some breathing room, but not when it's attorney error.
That's correct, but in a criminal case, the defendant does have a constitutional right to the effective assistance of counsel, and I think in that specific, very limited circumstance, this is an appropriate remedy.
Does the circuit court have any authority to send a case to the Court of Appeals or refer a case to the Court of Appeals?
I am not prepared to answer that question. I don't know. I don't believe so.
The motion or something was, well, a petition for habeas corpus was filed in the circuit court.
Correct.
Circuit court could hold a hearing, could make findings of fact, really determine whether in the view of the circuit court there was good cause for extending the time, and then say, court doesn't understand that it has any authority to extend the time, and so counsel can appeal the decision that I'm denying
okay.
the extension. What's wrong with that?
I think requiring an appeal could be a little bit of a cumbersome process. I mean, I understand that, you know, appeals happen all the time, but if we're talking about someone who is not indigent. They'll have to pay a filing fee in the Court of Appeals. It's just not a very streamlined process to say, I'm going to deny this because I don't have the authority, but go ahead and appeal and the Court of Appeals will sort it out. You know, if this court wants to say that you can file a claim like this in the Court of Appeals and the Court of Appeals has some authority to transfer it to you can file this in the circuit court and there's some mechanism where the circuit court can transfer it to the Court of Appeals to provide the remedy, I think that would be much preferable to requiring an appeal of the adverse decision in the circuit court.
Can you think of any circumstances where a court just vacates the judgment of conviction without there being other consequences of that? I mean, typically when you take a plea, you find the person guilty and enter a judgment of conviction. That's all kind of part of the same thing. So how do you just unwind part of that without creating the opportunity to unwind a lot more? I'm not getting the authority for doing that.
That could be a concern, and I think if this court were to approve of the state's proposed remedy, it would have to make very clear that the only thing that can be done is reentry of the judgment. It does not affect any of the underlying procedures. That any challenge to the underlying appeal or underlying trial, sentence, guilty plea, whatever, is really why the court's reentering it in the first place.
I'm really not trying to give you a hard time, but it sort of seems like you're just asking us to sort of make that up.
I'm sorry.
I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I'm just trying to figure out where we get that from. It just seems like, oh, well, let's make it up for this case this day. And it just troubles me a little, because sometimes there are unintended consequences when you just sort of unwind a judgment of conviction. That's a big deal.
I agree, and I think it is an awkward remedy for the circuit court to engage in here. But reconciling what happened in this case and where this claim should be filed, I think my position is the case law pretty strongly suggests this should be filed in the trial court. And what is the trial court then supposed to do if that claim is properly before the court?
And for me, you just hit upon your service to the court in this regard, because you are appears, when you say it is an awkward remedy, a remedy that you don't feel totally comfortable with, but you feel compelled to advance because you think case law requires it or points in that direction. So if your remedy is not acceptable to the court, and if it is to be filed in the Court of Appeals, what case law has to be modified, if any? Because it sounds to me like you're trying to squeeze some case law into the remedy, that the case law is driving your remedy.
I don't think any case law has to be modified in the sense that there's no case that clearly establishes that this claim belongs in the circuit court. I think this court would have to expand Smalley and Santana to say basically any failure by counsel, whether it's trial counsel, post-conviction counsel, appellate counsel, to meet a deadline under 80930, because counsel was ineffective, should be filed in a Knight petition. And to the extent this court might want to criticize the language in Quackenbush, which is counsel said was dicta, that maybe it doesn't make a lot of sense to file these claims in the Court of Appeals, this court could say, well, that's wrong too.
Yeah. In other words, Quackenbush is one of the cases that we're going to have to touch. We may have to touch.
Yeah. I don't think the holding in Quackenbush is any obstacle here. The difference between Quackenbush and Evans, I think, is in those cases it was counsel who goofed up by missing the deadline, writing to the Court of Appeals and say, hey, I missed this deadline. Give me an extension so my client can have an appeal or file a notice of intent. And in Evans, it was a defendant who was claiming that missed the deadline, or he was seeking reinstatement of his direct appeal rights. It wasn't any missed deadline, but he was criticizing his counsel's performance versus counsel saying it was my own error that caused the missed deadline.
Could I ask, as I understand the position of both counsel, you're saying this has to be a habeas petition. Habeas petition, you say one place, does another place. Why couldn't it simply be a motion under 80982 sub 2?
A motion to the Court of Appeals?
Yeah.
Evans, I think, pretty much forecloses that. Evans says when you're claiming ineffective assistance of counsel for some error in the appellate process, this is assuming it needs to be filed in the Court of Appeals. A motion for an extension of time is not the method of resolving an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Well, maybe you don't phrase it quite that way.
If Mr. Kyles can show good cause why his appellate deadline should be extended, he can file a motion in the Court of Appeals.
Well, now, if it was a Knight petition.
Correct.
And you're arguing, or somebody's arguing, ineffective assistance of counsel, aren't they going to send that right back to the trial court for a hearing?
Assuming they can't, there are factual disputes that can't be resolved from the petition, yeah.
Okay. Well, why couldn't they do that under 80982 sub 2?
I think, I'm trying to remember if Quackenbush sort of touches on this and says, well, maybe in some circumstances we can, if we need to refer a motion for evident, for an evidentiary hearing we can, although I'm sorry, I'm not remembering if they did or did not, if they said that we can't do that, but the extension practice, extension motion practice in the Court of Appeals is designed to be rather summary. I'm thinking to the Evans case where the defendant applied for his extension motion. It was granted 2 days later. State's experience when it requests lots of extension motions in the Court of Appeals, they get resolved often, almost always, without any input from the other side. I think when you have an ineffective assistance claim, that this court in Evans, I think, rightly concluded that the much better procedure is to have a more of an adversarial proceeding, such as a Knight petition.
Can I ask a very unfair question?
Sure.
Have you ever seen any grounds for an appeal in this case?
In the record before us, no. I did handle the federal habeas petition that was filed in this case, and if I can tell the court that he had a ground that he wanted to raise challenging his guilty plea. And it was a ground that the trial court did not explain to him, that the difference between initial confinement and extended supervision, something that I think was an open issue perhaps when he was convicted, but that the Court of Appeals has since rejected as a ground for being able to withdraw your plea. Other than that, I don't know anything.
Part of your judgment of conviction idea doesn't really seem to mesh to me with Evans. It seems like essentially you're finding a different way to extend time by doing this magic with the judgment of conviction. And the Court of Appeals can't do that, but you're kind of saying the trial court should be able to do that.
I think that's a legitimate criticism of our position. But again, if this claim belongs in the circuit court, and we're going to, and I believe it does, and it's in a habeas petition, the court does have the power to craft an equitable remedy, and our position is that in the very limited circumstance of proving this particular ineffective assistance claim, that is an appropriate remedy. Briefly, our position is also that the most recent Knight petition is barred by the prior filings. The petitioner has already filed a Knight petition. He's filing another Knight petition. If he thought there was something wrong with the Court of Appeals' original decision on the Knight petition telling him to go to the circuit court, he could have filed a motion for reconsideration. He could have petitioned this court for review. The basis of that argument is Smalley. That was decided several years before his original Knight petition. If the state is right that the circuit court is the correct forum to raise this claim, Kyle has already pursued relief in that court as well. The circuit court asked him to submit the letter, and he didn't. He instead appealed to the Court of Appeals. In that sense, I think that is a dismissal with prejudice. His appealing converted it to that. He claims he doesn't now. He doesn't have a copy of that letter, but he could have told the circuit court that. He could have told the circuit court what the contents of the letter were, but he didn't. And finally, his most recent Knight petition has far more factual allegations than any of his previous filings. He should have alleged all that in his original motion, and maybe we wouldn't be here today. Unless there are any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hennick.
In answer to one of the earlier questions, I do not know of any process through which the circuit court can essentially certify an issue to the Court of Appeals. There is 808.075, I think it's sub 5, 6, 7, one of those where the Court of Appeals can remand to the circuit court for specific findings, either on motion or on its own motion. But I am not familiar with any process for doing it the other way. With regard to 809.82 and why we can't just file a motion to extend time, the problem with that, as the state pointed out, is Evans. I think I've been around too long. I also argued Evans and lost that case. And I was the one who filed the motion to extend in that case. And Our argument there for the motion to extend was that not so much that this was ineffectiveness of counsel, but that it was good cause because the lawyer made a mistake. The court construed that as being an ineffectiveness claim and held quite clearly that I was wrong and that this has to be raised by a Knight petition if what you, in effect, are arguing is ineffectiveness of counsel. Now, if the court wants to overrule Evans, I'm not going to argue against that, and we can go with the logic that Quackenbush has and say that a lot of these things can more efficiently be handled by a motion to extend in the Court of Appeals, but we didn't brief that, and so I'm not really prepared to argue that any further. With regard to whether there are grounds to appeal, I don't know whether there are grounds to appeal since I was only appointed for this particular argument on these issues. However, I would point out that the U.S. Supreme Court in Roe v. Flores-Otega and the Penson case and the Seventh Circuit in Betts all pointed out that when you're abandoned by counsel, when your counsel's actions result in a denial of the appellate process, prejudice is shown by the fact that you do not have that appellate process. You do not have to show that there is a particular non-frivolous ground to raise for the appeal. Just the fact that you were denied a lawyer looking through these materials to find something, just because you were denied a court overseeing that in the case of, for instance, a no-merit appeal, you are prejudiced for purposes of the Constitution and the Sixth Amendment.
Do they call it a structural error?
I don't recall whether they call it a structural error or not. I know in Smith v. Robbins, dealing with the an error in the no merit, where the defense counsel failed to raise an issue in a no merit that was non-frivolous, I believe it's that case, they distinguished between what the defendant had there, which is a no-merit appeal. They had some kind of a process there, where in those circumstances you do have to show actual prejudice under the Strickland standard, and distinguishing that from the situation that we have here, where there was no appeal process at all. And under the latter circumstance, the defendant's not required to show prejudice because it's like not having a trial. You don't have to show that you would have won the trial. You were entitled to a trial and you were not given that process. You're entitled to an appeal in this case, and he wasn't given that process. That is sufficient prejudice under the Constitution. And unless the court has additional questions.
Well, I do. And that is, we've been cited numerous cases that slice and dice the fact situations and then come up to a conclusion of in what court the objection should have been made and how. And on the basis of your experience, is there a simpler way of doing all this? I mean, I'm back to where I have to juggle all these numbers and all these provisions and all these fact situations to come up with an answer. I mean, the rule is you bring the matter to the court in which the lawyer made the error. I mean, that sounds simple.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Except you can't figure out where he made the error or she made the error. I mean, that's what you're disagreeing on.
Yes.
So what other rule is there to make it simpler, or what provision should be made simpler, or is this good matter for a rule proceeding in dealing with all of this?
Well, there are a couple of considerations in my experience. First of all, a challenge to the effectiveness of counsel, as we know, can be raised in the circuit court, it can be raised in the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. An error in the Supreme Court, I don't think that we want to have the circuit court deciding whether or not there was a mistake in the Supreme Court, because then you're essentially directing the Supreme Court to do something. If it's an error that's clearly in the Court of Appeals, and that's a Fuentes decision that discusses that. If it's an error in the Court of Appeals, and it's clearly the Court of Appeals, then we don't necessarily want the Circuit Court to be citing that essentially the Court of Appeals made a mistake. So there's a problem with kind of just consolidating these things into just make it wherever you want to make it. I'm not saying that that's a deal breaker, but it's certainly something that the court should keep in mind with that regard. And I forgot where I was going from that point. I apologize.
Well, you're going to go home.
I'm going to go home, yes.
The red light's on unless there's further questioning.
Can I ask one
Justice
other
question? Justice Prosser.
On page 6 of your brief, where you lay out all of the things that happened before, on 12-308, Kyles filed a pro se motion to extend deadline for filing notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief. My recollection is that the Court of Appeals denied that on the grounds, not so much on the merits, as you're just too late here.
Yes.
What do we make of that in considering the present?
Well,
could we say you're just too late here? Were they wrong?
Well, there are different standards. The standard under 80982 for an extension of time is based on good cause. I know that the Court of Appeals has incorporated in Quackenbush, there's a reference to the fact that the longer the delay, the better the cause you better show. In contrast, in a habeas petition, it's an equitable remedy. Excuse me. And the court has recognized that the defense of latches would apply there. And latches doesn't necessarily apply in the motion to extend, but it does apply in a Knight petition. It's never been alleged that Mr. Kyle should be subjected to latches because latches essentially is based on sitting on your rights. And as we can see from the first multiple pages of our brief, that's the last thing he's done. He has made every effort that you can expect someone in his position to make to try to get a decision on his issues. The state was on the receiving end of those motions. It clearly was not surprised by the fact that he is attempting these things. And merely reinstating the direct appeal, there's nothing that I could see that would necessarily prejudice the state in that. So the state hasn't argued latches. I don't think that it applies here. They had good reason not to argue it. But that's a different standard than the abuse of discretion standard that applies to an extension of time under 80982.
I want to thank you, Attorney Hennick and Attorney Aaron, for your arguments today in the Kyles case involving in what court conviction used generally to mean appeal to should be brought and. As you know, it involves a matter that we've had before, in which a reconsideration is still pending. And we want to thank you for your arguments. And that concludes 2012 AP 378W, Lorenzo D. Kyles v. William Pollard. The court is in recess until 1:30, when you will hear the third case today.